Thank you for joining us on this edition of On Your Money. And we would be pleased if you would join us with your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, who will have some holiday shopping advice, tips to avoid post-holiday financial struggles, and some somewhat surprising news about how discourteous we are in Wisconsin when it comes to customer service calls. Really? I can't believe that. What schmucks did that study anyway? Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us from our igloo in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy. Pretty
darn cold, but let's warm up with warm thoughts of our wonderful listeners. We didn't quite make our ridiculously high goal during the mini pledge drive last week, but we came pretty darn close. About 250 pledges for more than $14,500 raised during this hour alone, Kevin. Isn't that wonderful?
It is wonderful, and thank you very much. And the pledge premium that people were requesting was the 60 ways to save $50. And we used that actually for three membership drive shows of On Your Money, 3 hours in the last quarter here. And 658 people pledged during those 3 hours.
Wow.
So we're very grateful for the support, both in terms of the nice comments that many of you made and the dollars that you pledged, and just the letting us know that you're there and you listen to the show and you enjoy it. And as part of our gratitude, next week we are going to do an all questions answered show where we are going to spend the entire show answering your questions. So send them in now to onyourmoney@wpr.org. or contact me directly at kevin@onyourmoney.com, or call in during next week's show.
Sounds great. Looking forward to that. And we pledge to continue to bring you great personal finance programming in the year to come as well. You know, there was this recent survey on customer conduct, and I was surprised by this, Kevin. Wisconsin residents did not fare well in one specific category. What's going on?
Well, it was kind of surprising. A company called Marchex analyzed 600,000 customer contact phone calls with the various companies they served over the last 12 months and measured them for the amount of profanity used by the different respondents in different states, and also how polite they were. And the most profane callers in the database were in Ohio, Maryland, and New Jersey. The ones who used the least amount of profanity were in Washington, Massachusetts, and Arizona. And in terms of measuring how polite they were, the most polite ones, and according to the survey, this is ones who said please and thank you in the conversation, were in the South, South Carolina, North Carolina, Maryland, Louisiana, Georgia. And the state which had the least amount of people who said please and thank you were in Wisconsin.
Yeah, we don't say please or thank you, at least not when we're making these customer service calls, apparently.
To defense of this great state and its fine residents and the listeners of Wisconsin Public Radio, this company actually serves outbound telecommunications for companies, meaning that they do handle some inbound, but a lot of it is actually like a telemarketing-based thing. So I have to be perfectly honest. I try and aspire to be a polite person, but I do not say please and thank you to calls that interrupt my dinner.
No way. You don't have to say please or thank you. They're lucky they didn't get Ohio treatment.
Wait. You just may have coined a new phrase.
Ohio
there, Joy.
Treatment.
I like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I saw in the study that we were in the goody two shoes category, though, when it came to swearing. So while we don't say please or thank you,
we just don't say anything.
Yeah, right. We don't swear at them anyway. Well, I'm assuming in a few weeks there are going to be plenty of frustrated customers out there. What advice do you have, Kevin, to avoid losing our cool and getting the customer service that we need?
Well, in terms of gift shopping, one step is the most important step, and that is going to be save your receipts. No matter what problems you have, there is definitely going to be a need for a proof of purchase, price paid, date, purchased, place it was purchased, all that. And especially with many retailers now are getting much tougher on returns, and they're not as amenable to just taking things back and saying, oh, yeah, go look for it, in part because, you know, they're trying to run as tight a ship and eke out as much profits as they can, but also because there's an increasing amount of fraud related to returns as well. You also want to, you know, that card that tumbles out of the box when the kid opens it up, grab that warranty card, make sure you not only read it, but complete any information there, because that's going to be a backstop for a lot of these companies. If there is a problem with a gift 3 to 6 months down the road, they're going to say, well, you know, you never registered your warranty with us, so we don't know which product you have or where you purchased it. Also, the other reason that the receipt is valuable is that when you get your credit card bill in the mail in January, you want to save the receipts and go back and make sure that the dollar amounts that you signed off for were the ones that were actually charged to the credit card, because sometimes there are some discrepancies, errors along the way, or extra charges added, and you want to make sure that you are only paying for how much you wanted to pay.
What preventive steps can be taken?
Check any return policies if you do purchase a higher ticket item, and read any directions about the gift or item for assembling it or operating it online in advance. Usually if you go to the company website, you can check it and make sure if it's possible to get it out of the box and try it before you give it to the person and make sure that it works. And also you might want to look at, go to a place like Amazon, and even if you didn't buy it there, look at a lot of the customer reviews of the particular product, because many of there's a lot of good reviews and information of people there who say, I had a problem with this thing and then I did this and this and it seemed to work. And a lot of times the common problems with a product tend to bubble up to the top and end up with comments on Amazon.
What if we eventually need to call customer service?
You need to pick a time that works for both you and the customer service people. During the day, a company called Zendesk, which helps customer service software providers, they said that the earliest is best. Try to call between 9 and 10 a.m. They said that is the best time to not only have the lowest amount of wait time, but also to get your problem resolved sooner rather than later. So schedule a time when you're going to do it. Try to multitask. You know, you're going to be on hold for a long time. So if you have a cordless phone and a headphone, put it on. You can, you know, do the laundry or clean or listen to public radio or something like that. And during the conversation, write every single thing down, not only for your future reference, but if there is a problem, that you have some notes to back up anything that you were told by the customer service person. And it's probably a good idea to be nice. Ask the customer service rep how they're doing, how their day is going. Say please and thank you as well.
Thank you, Kevin. And we also thank you if you'd like to join in with a question at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Any personal finance question is welcome, as always, during this edition of On Your Money. But since we just talked a little bit about customer service, I'm curious, do you work in customer service? Have you had to deal with rude customers? Do you think that Wisconsin customers are discourteous? What do you think people should know before they call customer service? Or how do you try to get the best customer service if you're a customer? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm sorry, it's onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. This is the On Your Money email bag. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and Andrew sends this email. I will be getting married this summer. I will most likely ask for WPR donations in my name when I register. Wow. If people contribute, how do I know if I can write off this donation, or does the contributor write it off instead?
Huh. I love the sentiment, mm-hmm. especially when some weddings can turn into a, hey, where's my money? I did watch a rerun of Goodfellas and the other day, and saw that fine mafia wedding scene where, you know, the main character is getting married and everybody just keeps piling these envelopes full of cash in it, and they're kind of humbled by it. Now, I've been to some weddings where it's almost like, you know, this was the whole deal, is to get not only a payoff on the investment of the wedding, but some money to start with. So I really like the notion, Andrew, and hopefully Andrew already has an intended bride and isn't just, you know, focusing on the wedding rather than the actual marriage for it.
Yeah, and she agrees with this.
And she agrees with it, right. Yeah, this could be a bad way to kick off the marriage if he is going to give all the money to Wisconsin Public Radio and she has other intentions for it. So it's a very practical way. The good of the bad news is, Andrew, the deduction only goes to those who actually write the check, who contribute to the charity, and they do have to itemize to get the deduction as well. So that's very important. Probably 40% of taxpayers next year in 2014 are going to take the standard deduction, and so many of those people will not be able to itemize their generous gifts to Wisconsin Public Radio or any other charity that they make in this manner.
Can Andrew get the deduction?
He can. What I would suggest is set up a special account in his and his spouse's name at their bank or credit union, and just deposit all of the money from the gifts into that for charity. And then once the money is received, you know, if it's $500, $1,000, whatever, they can lump sum donate that and then to get the deduction themselves to the organization, again, assuming they itemize in that particular year.
What if Andrew wants to get the deduction for the donors?
He can contact the charity. I'm sure the good people at Wisconsin Public Radio and other charities would say, yes, we will gladly set this up for you in a way that we can handle the donations, recognize the donors, thank them, track it, and so Andrew and his spouse know to send the gifts out for it, and then the donors can actually get the deduction. There are also places like justgive.org, which have special accounts set up, so especially a lot of people use an online registry or something for their wedding and information about it, to share pictures. Well, they can put a Just Give button on their website that then allows people to donate electronically in the name of the happy couple.
Well, I hope this starts a trend. This is great. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Andrew. And if you would like to send an email for consideration for a future On Your Money email segment, it's onyourmoney@wpr.org, onyourmoney@wpr.org. And remember, since next week it's an all-questions-answered edition of On Your Money, you can send your question for that in advance, too, via email. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And let's take a call from Feroz in Madison. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead. I understand you have some tips to get good customer service.
That is correct. I feel that a lot of people that call customer service, if they don't get the help that they need, they tend to get out on the representative. And I think one of the things that people can do when they call a call center is be polite with the rep, but be persistent.
And are you a customer service rep, Feroz?
I work in a customer service environment. I'm not a rep myself, but I do a lot of work with customer service.
All right, so be polite and be persistent. All right.
Yeah, just keep in mind, and Feroz is exactly right. I'm pretty sure whatever problem you are experiencing with a particular product or service or trying to take a trip or whatever, I can just about guarantee the person to whom you are speaking on the phone did not directly cause that problem.
Thanks very much for that tip. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is On Your Money. I'm on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. And now we go to Linda in Milwaukee. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Kevin and Joy. I really enjoy your show and your sensible advice. That's my praise.
Thank you.
Not even false praise. Thank you very much, Linda.
I'm single and have no dependents, so I don't need to protect my assets at death. And listening to your show, I will have more than 200 times my net monthly expenses, excluding Social Security and pensions. So I'm wondering, should I consider a Mutual of Omaha $600 a year premium that would give me a $100,000 maximum lifetime benefit that I could take with maybe $2,500 a month over a number of years for long-term care insurance like nursing home, assisted living, or they'll let you take $1,000 a month to pay someone however you want yourself until the money's spent. What do you think?
Linda, I thank you for your kind words. And when you speak of our ratios about being financially independent in retirement, it's necessary that you have at least 200 times your net monthly expenses after Social Security and pension. When you say it, it sounds so smart. I should have everything interpreted through you. So thank you very much. So what you're asking, Linda, is you have the chance to purchase this policy, and it's $600 a year in premiums, you said?
$1,600.
Okay, so we're looking at about $130 a month, and for that, you can basically get $100,000 in almost like a bank account. Is that right? That you can kind of use to within parameters for some kind of long term care expenses.
Yes.
Okay.
$2,500 a month until the $100,000 is gone for assisted living or nursing home or professional help at home if I need injections or any of that.
you already checked to make sure to see if they actually cover injections. Good for you, and I appreciate that. Can you afford the premiums right now?
Yes.
Okay. Would it make you feel good to have the policy?
I'm not sure. I'm afraid I'm going to live to 100 and that it would be a good idea, but then I could be hit by a bus next week.
Mm-hmm. So both of those things are possible. Neither is likely, but both are possible. And actually, it's probably more likely that you do live to be 100, especially if you look both ways when you're crossing the street. And so what I'd like you to do is, if it feels good and you're considering it, start the policy, because you can always cancel it at any time, mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah.
And so for whatever reason you decide you don't want it, or there is a better solution out there for you, or you can't afford the premiums, you can cancel it. And in the meantime, you have the coverage. Where people become disappointed with policies like these, Linda, is when they purchase them now, saying, all right, I'm younger and healthier now, and I can afford the premiums. I'm buying something today so that when I'm 85 or 90 or 95 and I need it, this will come in handy. And it's highly likely that either you won't need it, or the company will raise the premiums at some point. They can't do it just willy-nilly. They have to do it according to certain guidelines that do help protect the policy owners. Or the company may not be able to support you in the manner in which you're hoping and to pay for 20 or 25 years and then ask that question. So what I'd rather have you do is look at it in the sense of, all right, I'm going to make this $130 premium payment today. And that means I have 30 days of coverage. So knock on wood and everything else, if I am hit by a bus, I have some extra coverage above and beyond my normal assets and Social Security and whatever resources are out there. And then in 30 days, I'm going to have another premium due, $130. And if I have the money and I want that policy and I want 30 days of coverage, I'm going to pay it again, rather than hoping it becomes a 25 or 30 year proposition. So if you can do it in that sense, I would do it, because you can always cancel it. And it's very difficult to get on this as you get older and get more likely to need the services provided.
Perfect. That's a great way to think about it.
Thank you very much, Linda, for the call and for the genuine praise. Bill in Madison is with us. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Joy. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Bill.
Say, first, I'd like to give Kevin a big shout-out that I feel any listener that gets a chance to hear you live and in person should definitely do that. A few years ago, I heard you speak, and it really was an eye opener, and it was also enjoyable.
Well, thank you. Part of that is because of my stunning good looks in person. It just overwhelms any idiocy that comes out of my mouth. So thank you, Bill. I appreciate that.
Well, you notice I said live. And by the way, I heard you at the Madison chapter, the AAII.
Yeah.
What?
throw the II in there, because I certainly support AA, but I haven't been forced to go there yet. You never know, but okay. Not yet.
But, well, my question is, I am retired. I'm collecting Social Security. The bulk of my assets are in a conventional IRA, and I have a small Roth. And I was thinking of converting, and I know you have that rule of thumb about line 43 income.
Mm-hmm.
But I am collecting Social Security, and I understand that if I do that conversion, it'll reduce the amount of Social Security I get.
Yeah, that's a great point. Right. It doesn't necessarily reduce the amount of Social Security you get. You still get the same checks. But are you under the age of 66?
I'm 64.
64, okay. So you're under normal retirement age. Conversion does not reduce the amount of Social Security. What may do it, since you're under the normal retirement age, is actual earned income, and it's about $14,300 of earned income. Once you do that, then any dollars earned over that can start reducing your Social Security somewhat. It's not dramatic until you start earning a lot more money than that. And that's only if you're collecting Social Security under normal retirement age, which can be 66.
Well, are things like my wife and I's income now is her pension,
mm-hmm.
and then just dividends and interest and
sure. No, that's passive income, and that does not affect it from an earnings reduction standpoint. What it may affect and may create a problem if you do convert an IRA to a Roth IRA is Social Security is technically tax-free. But there is a formula that is used for everyone who's collecting Social Security in retirement. And how it works is they take half of their Social Security and then add it to all of your other income. And that's pensions, dividends, interest, even income interest from tax-free municipal bonds is included into this formula. And then they add that up. And if you go over certain thresholds, then a portion of your Social Security is taxable as income. And that's it's $34,000 for married couples filing jointly. If that formula comes out with a figure greater than $32,000 or $34,000, then half of your Social Security is taxable as ordinary income. And if it goes over $44,000, then 85% of your Social Security is taxable. And so I would be very conscious of that when you are making this type of conversion. My guess is that you're probably already getting enough Social Security and distributions anyway where Social Security is probably taxable. And if it's not, you may get into a danger if you don't convert some of this to a point where you don't take anything out of the IRA, but then all of a sudden if you have a larger IRA, the mandatory distributions after age 70 and a half for both of you, then start triggering it. So I try to balance it out. And what I would do, Bill, is go online. We'll put a website up at onyourmoney.com later on for this link as well. But go to TaxCaster. It's the Google TaxCaster, and you'll find this site. And it allows you to put in your information, kind of see where you're at for taxation. And then also, there's another neat feature. If you do decide to convert some or all of your IRA to a Roth IRA this year, and you do your taxes in March or April, and you find out that, oh, gee, I was really pushed up into the higher tax bracket by this conversion, you can actually undo the conversion. And so you get kind of a do-over if you actually do the conversion, find out that your taxes were too high, and decide you wish you hadn't done it. You get to do it over as long as you do it before you actually file your taxes.
Thanks for the call, Bill, and good luck. So, Kevin, do you recall Bill heckling you at the speaking engagement?
I don't recall anything. I just stand up and start talking, and then they say, okay, sit down or go home. Then I stop talking. That's pretty much my entire presentation.
Well, we'll have to remember to let listeners know when you're having a public speaking engagement so people can see you live. That would be exciting.
I think kind of how the career is going to tail on the tail end of it here is where you and I will probably just be in Vegas doing like... 8 shows a week or something at the Palms or the Sands or something like that.
And it will be in shiny suits and overweight and stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to have a toupee like you won't believe.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. An open line for you if you have a personal finance question for Kevin. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Perhaps it has to do with some sort of end of the year personal finance move that you might want to make. Christy in Chippewa Falls is with us now. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I always enjoy learning on Tuesday morning from Kevin McKinley. My question is a smart way tax-wise to donate to a charity. Recently, I went through my financial planner, and there's a small fee. I don't know what that fee is. Should I just give out of my checking account? And you can ask whatever questions you need to be able to answer the question. Thank you.
Okay. I'm sorry, there's a small fee for the fee was charged by the financial planner, or you donated some money from your checking account? I don't understand.
I'm sorry. There was a small fee because I had a low return bond liquidated to create the donation.
Ah, okay. So a bond was sold. They charged you like a commission or a fee or something to sell that. And you were going to use that money for a charity or?
Yeah, that was given. But I'd like now to give a donation to a different charity. And is that the way to go again or a different way?
Well, one way that that if you do have investments, Christy, do you have any stocks or mutual funds that are outside of a retirement account like a Roth IRA or an IRA?
I have an IRA, a Roth, a traditional IRA.
Okay, but you have no other investments besides those accounts?
I have mutual funds also.
Okay. And the mutual funds are outside of the IRAs and Roth IRA?
No, they're within it.
Oh, they're within it. Okay. If that's the case, the best way to donate money is probably just through a normal check. And the fee that you receive sounds like it was just for selling the bond in advance rather than anything related to the actual charitable donation. So there's really no way to get around that. So otherwise, you just give the check and you will itemize next year. Is that correct?
Yes, I do itemize.
Okay, if you do itemize, then whatever you give in cash can be used as a tax deduction for you to a partial extent, and depends on your income, the type of donation, and the organization. But also in the future, for those IRAs, Christy, and for other people curious, you still can donate the required minimum distribution directly to a charity before the end of the year, and even if you don't itemize, it's a tax-free donation as long as it goes directly to the charity. So contact the charity first, and it does absolve you of having to take out that RMD as well. So keep that in mind once you get up near that age.
Thanks for the call, Christy, and good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. And it's time now for Smart Assets. We will continue to talk about year-end money moves with some words about college savings accounts. What should we know about year-end contributions to college savings accounts, Kevin?
These are those 529 plans, Joy. They're kind of like Roth IRAs for college expenses. You can make contributions either for yourself or for another person, and it actually can be anyone for whom you want to help pay for college at some point down the road. You maintain ownership of the assets, and you set up the recipient as the beneficiary, like a child or grandchild usually. And then once that person is ready to use that money for higher education expenses, you can pull the money out tax-free for qualified expenses. And the definition of qualified expenses is fairly liberal. Most people don't get hung up on that. You can also transfer the account ownership to another person. You can set up a new beneficiary and change that if for some reason the first beneficiary doesn't need the money, or do you decide you don't want to help that person out for whatever reason. Or you can even, as long as you're still the owner of the account, you can even pull the money out and spend it yourself however you want. However, you will pay taxes and a small penalty on whatever earnings your initial deposits have made in the meantime.
So why is this a year-end strategy?
Well, there actually can be a small tax break for Wisconsin residents with certain plans. This is the EdVest plan. And if you make a contribution for what's considered to be an immediate family member, and that's typically, you know, child or grandchild, you can deduct the contribution amount from your taxable income at the state level, up to $3,000 per contribution. So if you have, let's say, five grandchildren, and you want to put $3,000 into an EdVest account this year still, that's $15,000. You still maintain control of the amount, but it takes $15,000 off of your taxable income at the state level, which for most people, that probably saves them about $500 to $800, I would guess, in state income taxes on a $15,000 deposit.
So any thoughts on how these 529 plans can fit into our gift-giving plans?
Yeah, in part because hopefully you're seeing and talking to family members during the holidays, and you need some information for them from them about you know, birthdays, Social Security numbers, et cetera. You might also, a lot of times when grandparents make these contributions, they might set up the parents as successor owners. So if something happens to the grandparents, the money goes directly to the parent. The parent can then decide what to do with it and when to dole it out to the kid in question. And it's also a nice discussion time to say, oh, you know, we're setting this up for your college. Here's why we're doing this. You know, here's what I did when I was going through college, or I never had a chance to go to college because we couldn't afford it. So I'm making sure that money won't be the biggest barrier to you getting a college education.
Any tips for those who are thinking about making a deposit into a college savings account?
Yeah, something is definitely better than nothing. But I should have Linda back on to interpret this because it'll sound so much smarter. But we have the On Your Money four ways to pay for 4 years of college, and that's that. I really don't want people to get caught up with the notion that they have to pay for 4 years of college and dole out, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars for this. Try to pay for it in four different ways: savings, income, either the student or the parent while the kid's in school, borrowing either in the kid's name or the parent's name, and that generally is a much more, you know, it's kind of like eating an elephant bite by bite rather than feeling like you have to eat the entire elephant all in one fell swoop. And also, if you are working and you are a parent, you should make contributions to a Roth IRA first if you qualify. And the reason being is that you can borrow money to go to college, but you cannot borrow money to retire. So you have to make saving for retirement a priority. The neat thing about the Roth IRA is you can always pull the contributions back out at any time and for any reason. That includes for college expenses, if you should need to do it and can afford to do it. And those withdrawals, as long as they're the contributions, are tax and penalty free. And then finally, when it comes to investing in 529s, you usually have a roster of mutual fund options, kind of like in a 401k. They also have an age-based option, which, based on the child's age, the portfolio starts out more aggressive and then generally gets more conservative as the child nears the age of 18. And you can change that at any time if you want, but it's nice because it kind of puts it on a little bit of an autopilot or a glide path, so it just kind of slows down and becomes less volatile as the kid gets closer to actually needing the money.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, and he is with us just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. 1-800-642-1234 is our number if you'd like to call in with your personal finance question. You can also email us onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
So I went down to my favorite store, picked out three or four shirts or more, a pair of pants and a striped tie, and the man came by and said, "Yes, sir, cash or charge?" I said, "Just put it on my credit card." Write that dude up. Oh, convenient.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And in today's Shop Around segment, we'll talk about credit cards. We've previously talked about the virtues of using layaway for your holiday gift buying. And now Kevin McKinley says that credit cards are an even smarter way to pay. Is that right, Kevin? Hello.
Yes, Joy, that is right. As long as you do so responsibly, and it's a good way to protect your purchases and the price you pay for it, and also get some perks along the way. But watch out for pitfalls.
So how can a credit card be used to protect a buyer?
There are actually two ways. First of all, it may help withhold the payment in the dispute. Sometimes if you buy an item, especially a higher ticket item, there's a problem with it right away. If you find the problem right away and notify the credit card provider, they will sometimes hold the payment to the seller if there is a dispute and a problem with it. It gives you some leverage in trying to negotiate a reasonable settlement and something that you can live with and is okay with the seller too. Some credit cards also add on to the manufacturer's warranty, and in many cases, double-end warranties are very short right now for most products. And so this can be very helpful and take a warranty that might be only 90 or 180 days, take it out to 6 months or a year, as long as you use the specific card in question to purchase the specific product. So definitely check the terms of the card before you use it and see if you have that feature added on to yours.
What about protecting the price that a buyer pays?
Well, this is very tricky right now for holiday spending. A lot of people say, "Well, I'm just going to get everything right now. Then I know I have it, and it's all good to go." But some people say, "I'm going to wait till the end and then get the cheaper prices." And that typically doesn't work as well now, just because inventory management systems are getting so much better at the retailers. If you know they don't see as many discounting right at the end because what they have, and they're probably not ordering a lot more, and so they're better at controlling it, and therefore they don't need to discount the price as much. So you can be more comfortable buying now using the card in question. And then if the card covers it and the price drops later, many cards may make up the difference as long as it's purchased on an item that's covered and the card covers it as well. And it's usually up to a certain amount. It might be, you know, $250 or something. But this can then provide some assurance that you're going to get the item, but hopefully at the best price possible. And actually, you can use two websites that will track items' prices to kind of let you know if the price is likely to go up in the future. Or if you've purchased something, it will send you triggers to let you know that the price has gone down since that point. And they are CamelCamelCamel.com and Nifty, NIFTI.com. CamelCamelCamel.com, Nifty, NIFTI.com. And we'll put those links up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Well, I will forever remember CamelCamelCamel.
So much better than just CamelCamel.
Yes. So what about credit cards that offer, you know, points and miles and that sort of thing?
Another great way to save, but keep in mind that those are dropping in value in terms of what they can be used on and how they can be used as well. And if you do use a card solely for the miles or the points or the cash back, also keep in mind that just a month or two worth of interest can more than offset the value of any points or perks or dollars that you earn from using the card. And if you are interested, though, and you're a responsible person, you're able to pay your credit cards off every single month, you might want to look for one that does provide these awards. Capital One is usually the premier provider of dollar back and cash back cards. But go to creditcards.com/rewardsphp, creditcards.com/rewardsphp, and you can search for a bunch of rewards cards there and see which one fits best for you.
Yeah, so you said when we started, watch out for the pitfalls. So what's the downside of using the plastic?
Well, it might lead to overspending and exceeding your budget because it's just so easy to say, you know, I have $100 in my wallet and I have a credit card. And if I can use the card, I walk out of the store with the product and I still have the $100. And also, of course, the aforementioned interest charges. If you charge too much on the credit card and it's out of the norm of your spending, it may affect your credit rating. So be careful if you do plan on trying to get a loan in the few weeks after the holidays. Check with the company, the credit card company, in advance on purchases, because some of them now, in an effort to combat fraud, are actually blocking charges that are legitimate. You are making the charges, but they're out of your ordinary pattern. So you might want to check with the credit card company and say, I'm going to go into the store. I'm going to be paying for something with a credit card. It's going to be more than I usually spend. I just want to make sure that you're aware of that and that you don't block it and lead to an embarrassing moment at the register. And also, if you are using the card with a partner or spouse of some kind, check with that co-user and just say, look, I'm going to go out and buy your present right now. I want to know how much room I might have to spend, because that gives you a signal as to how much they might be spending on you. And in that nuclear escalation of gift buying, you can kind of know whether you're the Soviet Union or the United States.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, a certified financial planner, and our regular guest every week at this time for On Your Money. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Steve in Waukesha. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I want to make sure I say please and thank you first.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah. So basically, I'm a recent college graduate, and I work for AmeriCorps. So I have a service-based position, and so I'm able to put my loans into forbearance. And so I have very, very small income loans in forbearance, and my wife is also in school, and her loans are in forbearance. However, she has unsubsidized loans. And I'm just wondering if the best thing to do would be to try and cut off and you know, chip away at those loans with some money I have in the bank, or since I'm at a kind of a low income situation, you know, maybe getting a Roth IRA would be better at this point. So, I'm not sure in a long term situation what's better, get rid of those loans or pulling into a Roth IRA right now. So,
these are great questions, Steve, and I applaud you asking them. So thank you. The thing I'd like you to have you look at is, first of all, in your fairly, I don't want to say tenuous situation, but you're relying on one income now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. I'd like nothing more than you to have a bunch of money saved up that you can access at any time, and I'd like it to be someplace safe. Typically, I'd like you to have at least 6 months' worth of living expenses, hopefully more. And then and only then would I start focusing on saving for retirement or paying off the loans. And today I'd probably rather have you go with paying off the loans. And the interest rate's probably over, is it the 6.8% and above loans that you're looking at?
Typically. I mean, they've shifted over the last couple of years, obviously. But, yeah, they go up to 8% for some of them. So
okay.
They get fairly substantial.
Absolutely. And that's a guaranteed investment return for you. You know, I'm a big fan of low-interest debt being paid off as slowly as possible, such as mortgages. But when it comes to those student loans, get a 6 months to a year's worth of living expenses set aside. And then anything above that, start sliding over and retiring the loans. I just don't think interest rates are near an all-time low on investments, and the stock market in the United States is near an all-time high. There's not a lot of return, I think, in the long term that's going to exceed the guaranteed cost of those higher interest student loans. So you're right to ask. I definitely have you retire those loans first before you save for money in the Roth IRAs.
Great. Well, thank you so much for that.
Thank
you're
you,
welcome.
Steve, for calling. Sam in Oconomowoc is with us now. Hello, Sam.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
So I just want some recommendations on dealing with credit card companies. I'm 20 and I just canceled my first credit card because they were taking 4 or 5 days to put money back on my card after I paid it. And I went on a trip down to Kentucky and they blocked it, and it took them 4 weeks to reactivate my card, even though I called 4 or 5 times.
Wow.
And each time I'd spend half an hour to an hour on hold.
And so you're asking about what to do when you open up a new card, or how to avoid the situation in the future?
Just how to avoid those situations, how to deal with them, how to get to the right person and get it unblocked right away, get it paid right away.
It's very difficult to do because you sound like a good and decent person, Sam. They have no way of knowing that when you first call them, and all they can see is the information in front of them, and they actually have limited power of to do that. One thing you might want to look at doing is, where did you get this credit card online, or did you answer a flyer in the mail?
I got it from U.S. Bank. I had a checking account, savings account there. I got frustrated with them and closed everything because they were very unhelpful on the phone, especially with the credit card.
Okay. You might want to did you move to a different financial institution when you closed out your other account?
Yeah, I went back to an old one. I went back to a credit union.
You're one step ahead of me. That's just what I was going to suggest. Not that, you know, necessarily the credit unions are better than banks, but they tend to have more of a they're required by charter, actually, to have more of a customer and community focus. That doesn't mean they're perfect, and many people are happy with traditional for-profit banks. But that's exactly what I was going to recommend, is go back to the credit union because, and again, the credit union actually isn't going to sponsor, you know, or actually be on the back end of the credit card that they sponsor an offer, but they might have one that's a little bit easier to deal with as well. And it's very tricky to handle those situations. Again, write everything down and get the terms for it and make them explain it to you so that you understand it rather than that, you know, that it's just clear to them to what's going on. But I think you've already taken the right step by going back to the credit union.
Thanks for the call, Sam. Good luck. Esty in Madison is with us now. Hello, Esty.
Hi, thank you. Question about leasing. I'm leasing a car for the second time, and I actually got this one just a few months ago, and I'm finding now that the gas mileage is not nearly as good as I was both led to believe and saw online. And so I'm thinking that I don't necessarily want to keep it for the whole 2 years that I signed up for. But I don't know how to think about the finances of that and how much it would, at what point does it make sense to return a leased car and either get another one or buy a different one, considering all the fees that I pay every time. And also, I wonder about the finances of leasing versus buying. Of course, when I lease, it's a brand new car and all that, and I have the maintenance for 2 years. And when I buy, I wouldn't be able to buy, most likely, a new car.
Esty, so, because we're almost we're running close to the end of the hour. Maybe some advice for Esty on leasing versus buying or turning in this leased car she has early?
Esty had some great points about the advantages of leasing and that you do get a newer car with much likely service cost over the life of the lease. The bad news is you're kind of stuck with that thing. But I would look at this. I would take it back to the dealership, explain your problem and issue, see what solutions they can offer you. Be aware that if you're doing this solely because of the cost of the gas, because you're not getting as good of mileage as you thought you were going to get, you will pay way more in transaction and service fees, depreciation, early cancellation fees to get out of that lease than you will in gas prices over the remaining of what sounds like a very short lease. So I'd sure check with the dealership, see what they can do for you. But otherwise, I'd ride it out and get something that hopefully is more suitable for you, really in a matter of months.
Thank you, Esty. Very quickly, because Jillian in Appleton is so nice in this email, I like this show because I'm not particularly at ease thinking about financial issues, and I'm confused about some fairly basic things and feel embarrassed to ask. So I appreciate the clarity that Kevin explains things, never makes anybody feel dumb, and is on our side. She no longer has confidence in the person who manages her investments. What procedure is there for switching to another advisor?
Well, you actually get to find if you're done. You actually have to find some place for that money to go if they're using an in-house, like it's a traditional brokerage advisor firm. If they're using like a Schwab as a custodian or something, which I do, or if they're using some other custodian, you really just have to take the person's name off the account. You can write a letter and say, I'd like you removed from the accounts, and they'll typically do that. If you want to find a new advisor, you have to start at the new advisor, and once you're comfortable with that person will initiate all of the transactions and the paperwork and handle everything that they legally can or should do it anyway, except for signing the paperwork and making sure that the assets are transferred over in kind for it. You want to ask about any fees that either party is going to charge, either to transfer the money out or to transfer it in. And if you just want something where you don't want to pay a lot of money for it, but you need a little bit of help and you want to do it yourself, you can go to a Vanguard or a Fidelity or a Schwab directly and have them take care of it, and they won't charge you a whole lot to do it. You won't get a whole lot, but again, if you're already not happy with the service you were getting, nothing that costs nothing is better than something that isn't helpful to you and still costs a lot.
Excellent. The website of the week, Kevin?
GetHuman.com to find a human being at all 8,000 different businesses and sellers. GetHuman.com.
Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money here on the Ideas Network.